Just enough Republicans in the House split with Governor Rauner to push through a plan for state spending and tax hikes. David Harris is a Republican from Arlington Heights.
My friends, let me tell you something very clearly. I was not elected as a state legislator to help preside over the financial destruction of this great state.
But there's no budget yet, and the governor promises a veto. We'll get an update on the latest in the budget battle in Springfield and what to watch for in the coming days. Plus, we answer some of the most common and quirky questions about the human body, like why do people crave terrible food at night?
Your low blood sugar tells you, you need to eat something. So if you go past that point where you should have gone to bed, people tend to want, I guess, what Taco Bell would sell to you as the fourth meal.
Doctor and Atlantic Magazine editor Jim Hamblin on his book, If Our Bodies Could Talk. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. It's 3 days into another year without a state budget. Over the weekend, just enough Republicans in the House joined with Democrats to push through a $36 billion spending package and tax hikes to pay for it. Republican Representative Terry Bryant is from Murfreesboro.
I hate tax increases, and it will hurt small business to do this. But I also think it hurts small business when you ask them to do business with the state and then we don't pay them.
But most House Republicans did not support the plans, including Representative David McSweeney from the western suburbs of Chicago. He says it would hurt businesses and drive more people out of Illinois.
Let's do what's right for the taxpayers of this state. They are going to get screwed again by Pat Quinn's budget.
And thanks to Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey for that tape. Those bills go next to the Senate and on to the governor, who has promised a veto. So where are we now? And what's at stake for schools, social service agencies, businesses, and taxpayers? Dave McKinney is a political reporter with Reuters. He's been covering the back and forth all weekend and joins us by phone. Dave, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian. How are you doing this morning?
Doing okay. At one point this weekend, House Speaker Michael Madigan said there would be no vote. Then he changed course, and we saw the spending plan and tax hike bills pass. The focus today is on the state Senate, but where are we right now in this long march toward a state budget?
Well, I mean, it was a kind of a momentous day yesterday in Springfield when we saw all these House Republicans, 15 in all, defect from their leader and from Governor Rauner and support a tax increase, increasing the individual rate from 3.75%. to 4.95%. All eyes are on the Illinois Senate right now. We don't know if they're going to be taking this up today or not, but they voted in May on a similar package. At least it contained the same language on the income tax increase. What's different now, as opposed to May, is that it's going to take more votes in the Senate to pass it. And that's kind of a bit of a wild card in the Senate because there are 37 Senate Democrats. If they chose to do this all on their own, they could, because you need 36 votes to pass it now. But I think that there are going to be some, you know, there's going to be pressure for some Republicans to be on board here. In that May vote, there were four Democrats who voted no, most from downstate, some from the suburbs. And, you know, those folks would have to either turn around or there would have to be Republicans joining on. So there's a bit of an unknown right now in the Senate.
Sure. And Dave, what's been the reaction so far to what transpired yesterday in the House, whether it be from, from other politicians, from business groups? What's been the reaction?
Well, I would say the most significant reaction is that we got our first sort of taste from the bond rating agencies this morning about what happened. I mean, Fitch put out a statement saying that they were encouraged by what they had seen. And you know, they talked in terms of thinking perhaps there would be enough to override Governor Rauner if he vetoes this. I mean, you know, Rauner last night, he wasted no time. I mean, it was within minutes of the House roll call, he put out a statement that was just, you know, full of anger about what had, you know, transpired. He said that he was going to veto it outright, that this was a bill that could have passed 2 years ago without reforms. And he's most angry that that any discussions on a property tax freeze, workers' compensation changes and the like have sort of come to a standstill. And so, you know, in a weird way, even though there's been this action, we're still very much in this kind of uncertain terrain about what, you know, whether we've found a way out, at least in terms of getting an FY18 budget.
You touched on the income tax increase that was approved yesterday by the House, bumping it up from 3.75% to 4.95%. Let's talk a little bit about what's actually in the spending plan that the House passed yesterday. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, the most interesting thing, as you mentioned in the lead-in here, it's a $36 billion package. It's less than what the governor's introduced budget was from earlier this year. But probably the most interesting component to it is this kind of political landmine that Democrats inserted in it. And it contained language basically forcing the governor to sign Senate Bill 1, which is a school funding overhaul that the Democrats have passed. And they wanted to bring into negotiations on the budget and have Rauner commit to signing it. The governor doesn't want to do it. But anyway, the language that was put in the spending plan is such that if Rauner doesn't sign the Senate Bill 1, then any funding for K-12 is null and void. So, we've got a bit of a confrontation woven into the spending plan here that is going to create consternation as well and a lot of uncertainty for our school districts.
Certainly. This is a good time to bring someone else into this conversation. Dan Cox is the superintendent of Staunton Community Unit School District Number 6. It's about 45 minutes northeast of St. Louis. Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
I know you've been going to the Capitol every day, at least over the past week, if not longer. What's your message through this time been to lawmakers?
Well, we urge our lawmakers, first of all, we're very happy with the political will and courage that was shown yesterday in those who voted yes. We are disappointed in the no votes, but are very thrilled that the measures did pass through the House, and we urge our Senate to pass it today. And the governor said if a balanced budget was presented to him that he would sign it, and we would expect to see the governor to sign the package of Senate Bill 6, 9, and 1 today if it was presented to him.
Yeah, we heard Dave McKinney mention earlier that there is a provision in the budget plan that if the governor does not sign Senate Bill 1, if he vetoes that legislation, that funding for K-12 schools would not go into effect. I'm curious your thoughts on that particular provision, and I guess leading into that, then your thoughts on Senate Bill 1 itself.
Senate Bill 1 is the best path for us to get a funding formula that's equitable, adequate. We've been struggling, schools have been struggling since what we would call the proration era in 2009, and Senate Bill 1 is the closest we've been in history or at least the last 20 years of getting us to a formula that would be equitable and adequate for all students. There would be no losers in that. It's widely supported by superintendents and school districts throughout the state. It has diverse support, and we would like to see that signed. It'd be very disappointing, and it'd be devastating to school districts. We're in the time now as school's ready to start in August. We're planning, and we don't know how to even plan for a budget or plan for what type of revenues we're going to have. The bottom line is if this doesn't get done, and the reason we're coming up to the Capitol and working so hard in talking to our lawmakers about this is if a deal does not get done, we go into crisis planning as early as this week, and many school districts are already there.
You know, your district, Dan, I believe, is pre-K through 12, about 1,300 students. How have the people in your district been affected by the budget crisis? And you mentioned since 2009 when school funding started being prorated, but really especially during these past 2 years.
Well, our retiring employees, we've not replaced them. Existing employees have been dismissed. Our elementary class sizes are routinely 29 students per class. Our junior high classes exceed 30 students per class. Many of the positions we've eliminated has done direct harm to our most vulnerable and underserved students, such as our special education and our students living in poverty. We've cut money for supplies and curriculum materials. Our technology's behind and lagging. Textbooks, in many cases, are 20 years old, or we've got classes that even go without textbooks. An example would be our fifth grade students. Some of them do not have reading textbooks, and we're waiting on a revenue just to order textbooks for this coming fall. Interventions for struggling readers are limited. We've had little to no social-emotional supports for our students in a time when many of our families are experiencing hardships and crisis. So as we continue to count on, unfortunately, we're counting on less and not more support from the state and taking on more responsibilities with fewer dollars, our ability to meet the growing needs of our students and families becomes more diminished as each day of the impasse goes by. And our teachers, despite their best and most heroic efforts, they're also feeling unsupported because of the lack of supports they're getting in the classroom.
You know, we were just talking with Dave McKinney as well about the progress being made toward a budget. You know, as we sit here today with that, with legislation pending in the state Senate, how are you feeling today, based on conversations that you've had with lawmakers in the state Senate? How are you feeling today about the prospects of the tax increase and the spending plan being passed over there?
I'm feeling optimistic. Again, yesterday in the conversations we had, and I can't say enough the support and we want to show for the individuals who voted yes. They really put the needs of our kids and put the needs over the state, over their party, and we certainly appreciate that and won't forget that, that they voted their district and chose their kids. And we would ask the Senate to do the same. We would ask them to do the same today and make a vote that's going to move our state forward.
Dan Cox is the superintendent of Staunton Community Unit School District Number 6, about 45 miles northeast of St. Louis. Dan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You bet. Dave McKinney, let's bring you back in this conversation. Governor Rauner has already said he'll veto this tax hike if it does pass the Senate. So if that were to happen, say the Senate approves that measure today or tomorrow here this week, what happens then if the governor vetoes?
Well, I mean, it sets up all of this is one of the most intense political chess matches I've seen in my career in Springfield. And I think what we have is a lot of uncertainty over what happens after the veto. I mean, will there be an effort by Democrats to override, or will they let the veto stand? Because, at the heart of this political question is ownership of a potential downgrade to junk status. From a Democratic standpoint, even though, many, many, many rank-and-file Democrats want to see a budget passed, there's a political calculation here that certainly for the 2018 governor's race, hanging a junk rating around Governor Rauner's neck is a desirable thing for Democrats. Again, Rauner has pretty much drawn a line in the sand here, and, in the next probably week to 2 weeks, we're going to have a clear indication of how this is going to play out, and I wish I could tell you how this override effort will play out, assuming it gets out of the Senate. It was a close vote, it will be a close vote in the Senate passing this. And like I said before, it will require probably Republican votes. But it's a very interesting game of chess, like I said.
The governor has been very explicit about saying he will veto the tax hike. What has he said, if anything, about the actual spending plan that was approved?
Well, he hasn't really focused heavily on that. Politically, the numbers are, there may be spending priorities that don't quite align with what his spending priorities are within that framework that the Democrats have sent to the Senate. But in terms of numbers, that overall spending plan is less than what he had proposed on the floor last night. We heard Deputy Majority Leader Liu Lang say that it was about $800 million less than what the governor had proposed. So I think it's going to be hard for him politically to stand up and thump his chest about how, the spending part of this is out of line. Certainly his focus has been on the tax increase piece of this and on the fact that the Democrats, as of now, have not given him the kinds of, what he calls structural reforms that he's been holding out for now for 2 years.
Of course, there's also $15 billion in unpaid bills that have piled up here over the last several years. Is there any provision at this point to start to pay that down?
Well, no. That's been that is a gigantic question mark about all of this. We haven't seen anything clear cut that would address that. I think the most logical way out of this is borrowing some amount to winnow down the nearly $15 billion in unpaid bills that we have dating back, to 2015. Even with the state's diminished creditworthiness, the rate that they would get to borrow would still probably be less than the 12% penalty per year that the state's paying on a lot of its overdue bills. But that, again, takes Democratic and Republican votes to pass because it needs a 3/5 vote in each chamber. And, you know, that wasn't anything that wasn't brought to the table last night. That's still out there hanging. And I would expect in the coming days that that's going to be something that gets addressed. The comptroller put out a statement last night highlighting this very issue, that this is, we've got a long way to go yet beyond what passed in the House to dig ourselves out of the hole.
So what should people who are watching this pay attention to here in the coming days for signs of progress or setbacks?
Well, I mean, you know, for the, I mean, really everybody who has time should ought to, you know, it's a holiday and all you have to do is go to your computer and go to ilga.gov and you can watch the video and audio of this unfold. Right now, the Senate is expected to come in this afternoon and the House is in a sort of a holding pattern. But what I expect to unfold is we're going to see some direction from the Senate here on Senate Bill 6 and Senate Bill 9, the two, you know, the spending and the tax hike. And that, you know, for the short term, that's going to be the interesting political theater, I guess, because will Republicans under a new leader, Bill Brady, and Chris Cerdonio resigned her position from the Senate and as legislative leader on Saturday, will the Republicans stay in the, in the Rauner camp, or will some of them defect as they did in the House? That's a big question. And then what happens if it passes? What happens next? How quickly does Rauner veto it? I mean, he could do it almost instantly. I think based on his strident language, that's probably what we would expect.
Dave McKinney, political reporter with Reuters, who's been covering the back and forth in Springfield. Dave, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, negotiations continue in Springfield over the state budget. Stay with this public radio station for all of the latest. Coming up after a short break, Dr. and Atlantic Magazine editor James Hamblin answers all kinds of questions about the human body. He'll talk with Nyla Budo about his book, If Our Bodies Could Talk. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. If you're interested in learning more about the human body, but maybe not so interested in curling up with a medical textbook on human anatomy or physiology, then a new book that's just out is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body might be for you. I'm joined now by its author, Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor turned journalist, and he's with us now. Dr. Hamblin, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think what I appreciated most about this is you start the book off with this interesting observation about ignorance, that it's actually something that's cultivated. And I wonder how you think the current atmosphere of information and the web and social media perpetuates this idea that ignorance is something that we're kind of all willfully cultivating.
Yeah. I spoke with this professor at Stanford who coined this term agnotology, sort of the study of the spread of ignorance. And not without getting too deeply into politics of the day, this is something that in the classic textbook case is sort of the tobacco industry, where you didn't need to really combat the argument that tobacco or that cigarettes cause cancer. You just needed to sow doubt, to spread the idea that everybody has their own opinion and there's no real consensus. You know, everyone's entitled to their own idea about whether or not cigarettes cause cancer. So let's just go on smoking if you believe that it's safe. It was an ignorance to the idea that anything can be known. And so yeah, I think there's similar stuff going on today.
Well, and I think especially with health and medicine, right? And I think I always have these conversations with my doctor about like what I've looked up online and where the sources are. I think as a journalist, I should mention Jim is a medical doctor turned journalist. He's now a writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. We're looking at sources, right? That's part of what we do. But I think there's a lot of medical information out there that may be easily accessible and may not be great sources or understood. How much do you think that contributes to a lot of misinformation or confusion about, or even, I think, even marketing, right? The way products are marketed for being healthy. How much is that just sort of creates a really difficult environment to know what is accurate about our health?
Yeah. And that's how the book is focused, as a lot of questions that I'm hearing frequently that people seem to be hearing conflicting messages on. And you'll often have an industry trying to tell you that, something is part of a healthy lifestyle or part of a healthy diet, like sugar cereals or soda. And the medical community is just saying, no, you can survive eating these things occasionally, but that's not part of a healthy diet. So you're hearing conflicting messages, and then you go to whatever you're sort of looking to find on the internet. When you start Googling, especially with health stuff, you could find someone who will confirm what you were hoping to hear.
Right. Well, and I think,
on their blog. Sorry.
No, go ahead. There are blogs for everything. And I think there are all these forums where people post sort of every ridiculous worst case scenario of something if you're looking up like a drug or a side effect or something like that. But when I think about that, I mean, I think you do this book topics, and we're going to get to there's a lot of topics in here that are great about our immune system and about nutrition and about our bodies and sex. But one thing that I think is a really kind of interesting question that is at the baseline of all of this is, and you talk about this, what's normal? And I think that's something that when it comes to our bodies, we tend to freak out about. And is there a way for us to figure out a gauge for that?
Yeah. It's a concept. The idea of normalcy is something that you need in science so that you can say, most people end up having, say, blood pressures that are in this range, and therefore we will call blood pressures outside of this range too high or too low. But specifically, a lot of times when we're thinking about our appearances, a lot of times when it comes to matters of how we distinguish ourselves, draw lines between races, genders, sex, based on parts of our bodies, we hold up ideas of normalcy that I think often could be challenged, and it's helpful to think that maybe a lot of people happen to be a one-way clumping around a sort of median and a bell curve, but it doesn't mean that it is necessarily healthy or that being outside of it is right or wrong always.
So this book follows a Q&A type format. You write about health and medicine. I mentioned you get a lot of letters and emails from people who have questions about their body. Is that what inspired this book?
Yes, it did. I get so many questions from readers, from friends, from colleagues who just don't read or write as much about health and science. And so I figured if I could put them all in one book, then I could just refer people to that instead of having to repeat myself.
Right. I wonder I wonder if you could share, like, what are some of the strangest things you've been asked that maybe didn't end up in the book?
Oh, I think we purposefully put this strange ones in the book. So I'm having trouble.
Like, do a lot of people come up to you and say, why do men have nipples? Like, I feel like these are kind of odd questions.
Yeah, that one is actually based on, so the entire idea of a book is sort of a send up of this mini genre of health trivia books. And there actually was a book titled Why Do Men Have Nipples?
That was the bestseller, right?
In here. Yeah. It was a very widely well-received book. And I wanted to take that genre and explore the depth behind the trivia. So not very few of these answers are extremely pithy and straightforward dinner party conversation, but get into the bigger ideas about why. The more interesting thing to me about nipples is that it is fundamentally the same structure in men and women, developed at the same point in our embryological development. And yet societally, we treat them in very, very different ways. It's illegal to publicly display female nipples in some states in America.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there is a whole interesting description, and there's a whole court case that you talk about in the book. You know, there is an interesting point about how you answer a lot of common, maybe not so common questions people have, but you also address, I think, some of the overlooked structural issues that are also tangled in with this, right? And I think you just alluded a little bit to that, talking about the way women and men are treated differently in terms of nudity. But what do you, I feel like you talk, there's affordable healthcare, homelessness, the environment. I wonder, when we think about healthcare and our bodies and health, what do you think is the most overlooked structural issue we're not really paying attention to right now?
You know, for all that it seems like we hear about food, about diet, and it's people trying to modify their diet to lose weight, I think it's talking about access to high quality food and the agricultural system that is going to produce that food and bring it to people, and how our subsidies for what we produce in this country are not arranged to have everyone have easy, cheap access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And I think there are just huge gains to be made when you look at the what some would call an epidemic of cardiometabolic disease in this country, with over half of people having some form of either being obese or overweight, as according to the latest numbers. So if you're looking for the sort of lowest hanging fruit, I think that's still the biggest ground to be gained is in the food supply.
I'm talking with Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. And Jim, you know, when you mentioned food and nutrition, that is, I think it's something people kind of perk up about when you talk about that. I want to ask you about milk, because this is, you talk about this. This is for, I think, a lot of people, Americans, we're growing up, we have been told repeatedly, you know, that you have to drink milk, that it makes you healthy and strong. There were all the commercials in the 80s, the milk, it does a body good campaign, which is probably sort of one of those campaigns that gets ingrained into little kids' minds. Is that true?
It certainly was ingrained in my mind. And then there was the Got Milk campaign with everyone having
all the celebrities
mustaches. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I didn't realize that there was federal funding that went into subsidizing that campaign, because we subsidized the dairy industry. And it turns out that there's nothing in milk that is not very easily accessible through fruits and vegetables and many other ways of getting these things. Usually people say calcium, vitamin D, and phosphorus, things that you need. Also, it's a good source of protein. But if you parse that, what's being sold to you there, they're just saying it's a good source of these nutrients, not it's the only source. And it turns out that within our food system, if you're just eating a bunch of white bread, peanut butter, and jelly sandwiches, then yes, it is good to add milk to that. But if you're eating a whole plant-based diet, then there's no need for milk.
Right. And so the idea is to look at, sort of look beyond that, right? That milk, the important thing about milk is that it's a source of calcium and vitamin D, and maybe look for that from other places too?
It is indeed an excellent source of those things, but it is far from the only one.
And I feel like you have this whole section on carbs versus fat versus diet trends. And I feel like this is also tough for people, lay people who are looking at this stuff, because there's always studies, there's always different headlines about this is good for you, this is not good for you, you should eat this, no, you shouldn't eat this. All the nutrition experts you've spoken with over the years, all the reporting you've done, is there anything that you think all nutrition experts would agree upon in terms of what we should be eating?
That's the big question. And I get into that in this book. I went to this conference where they purposely brought together a bunch of people who've sort of studied disparate areas of research, Mediterranean diet and the paleo dieting and veganism and standard American diet. Well, no one's really advocating for that, but, you know, have focused on.
What is the standard American diet? What does that mean?
Does
that mean McDonald's? That's what it sounds like you're saying.
Very high in processed carbs, very high in meat and dairy compared to the rest of the world, and very low in fiber and very high in added sugar. So you're more, when you're studying that, you're just looking at, you know, how is this hurting us? But anyway, the groups, people who have generally different conclusions sat down together, and what they, you generally can agree on minimally processed plant-based diet. So whole plants, a lot of them. Very few people are going to say, in fact, I can't think of anyone who I've spoken to who would say, no, don't do that. There's
Dr. Atkins
on how much. Yeah, there's disagreement on how much meat and protein people should have for optimal health. I don't think even Dr. Atkins wouldn't have told people to avoid fruits and vegetables, to my knowledge.
But that brings me to another question that you asked, which I really liked, which is, why do people crave terrible food late at night? Why do we think want things like pizza or sugary things?
Yeah, that was a question that came to me, and it seems that when your body is shutting down for the evening, it is there are hormonal fluctuations that make you sort of go into relaxed mode, being ready to sleep. And when you don't sleep, your low blood sugar tells you, you need to eat something. Whereas normally you need a low blood sugar while you're sleeping because you're not up and active and moving around. You're going to have to be supplying your body with energy. So if you go past that point where you should have gone to bed, people tend to want, I guess, what Taco Bell would sell to you as the fourth meal. So people who are chronically sleep deprived end up gaining weight. And eating more is just one of the reasons that happens.
One thing that I also think is a really interesting thing is cold weather and how I feel like when it's cold, people tend to crave carbs more, or they want sort of, is that true? Or is there any scientific basis to that? And I only say this as someone who was a native Floridian who moved to the Midwest and found that during the polar vortex, I would consume things like Chicago deep dish pizza, which I would never, ever otherwise eat.
That's really interesting. I know that when you are cold, your body is burning more calories. You're constantly maintaining yourself at 98.6 degrees. So when it's cold outside, you have to get the fuel to create that energy from somewhere.
No one's ever asked you that question before? I'm shocked.
No, I've not heard it. That's impressive. I can look more into it, but I know that if you're actually spending time outside in the cold weather, it makes sense that you would be hungrier because that uses more energy. But when you're out in the cold weather, your body is burning energy in order to maintain its core temperature, so it would make sense that you would be hungrier.
My guest is Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Stay tuned to hear more of this encore edition of the show. Coming up, we'll have more stories and news from across Illinois.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Dr. Jim Hamblin. He's a doctor, a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Jim, so I want to get into some more specific questions that we talked about here. We were just talking about nutrition and food, and there's a good section on hydration, which I think is the problem is with all of these medical things is everyone has these rules of thumb that they hear about, right? And the one, whether it's milk or whether it's a marketing campaign that gets ingrained as a rule of thumb, like that we should be drinking milk or we should be drinking 8 glasses of water a day. Is that true or false?
Yeah, that's so interesting because when you talk to hydration researchers, scientists, they tend to say that actually upsets a lot of people because it's pretty arbitrary and your hydration needs are totally dependent on where you are, the weather, how active you are, your own personal functioning of your kidneys. To make a rule like that can upset some people. But then when you get into behavioral psychology, it turns out that it actually helps a lot of people to have a concrete, simple thing to shoot for. And that just saying something like drink more water or try to drink a good amount of water
doesn't help. But if you say 8 glasses, it does.
Exactly.
Oh, that's
exactly.
Interesting.
So I have to say it's a reasonable rule of thumb, but it is pretty arbitrary.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because we've done programs on this, and I remember we got a lot of calls of people who are really upset because of one thing one of our guests said about the amount of water that they drank, and this was a professional marathon runner, but people were really upset because they said people can overhydrate, and that's very dangerous too. So what's sort of a good rule of thumb for monitoring whether or not, I mean, we all have different sizes. As you said, it's metabolism. For me, it's the size of my bladder. I mean, what do you think it is in terms of how much water we should be drinking?
Yeah. What I was told in investigating this answer is often urine color is a good one, that you should be going for clear to light yellow urine. So obviously that does not prevent the problem of overhydration, we do read about it in marathoners and in fraternity pledges who are forced to chug a gallon of water in half an hour. But in real life, it's extremely hard to do. There are psychiatric disorders where people become compulsive about drinking water.
Probably so also pretty rare, I would imagine. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very hard. If you're you have to kind of be very forcibly trying to drink as much water as you can in order for it to be a real problem.
But it is interesting when you think about news coverage, and I'm going to throw media coverage in there, of how that impacts what we think about health and medicine. And in particular, I thought it was fascinating. You write about this, the fear that people have of sharks. But when we think about sharks, how many people they kill a year worldwide based on how many, for example, people die from mosquito bites. I mean, how much of this is, again, I think, because of sort of the culture that we're surrounded with, or, you know, movies like Jaws?
Yeah. I think media, entertainment media plays a huge, huge part in this. And the sort of visceral fear of a shark tearing into your flesh is so much worse than a mosquito, which is killing so many people every year by spreading malaria and is, in fact, the thing that we're all much more likely to suffer by and should be concerned with.
You have a really interesting section about itches, speaking of this, and I wanted to ask you about this. You talk about there's one theory as to why our sensory systems have evolved to the point that scratching an itch is something that is pleasurable, right? And it may have something to do with the fact that mosquitoes are, as you're saying, very deadly. What's the link?
Yeah. So why would we itch? You know, it's one of those times that you're actually destroying or removing some dead skin cells from yourself, but to no clear purpose. So people have theorized, and one of the leading theories is that it has to do with insects and the infectious diseases that they spread, and that we are meant to get them off of us when we feel them, and that it makes more sense for us to have a low threshold for sensing an insect. So go ahead and scratch, even if there probably is nothing there, as opposed to waiting until you're feeling the bite before you react to it. So that's why we're constantly scratching ourselves all the time. At least that's one idea. It's a very complex and bizarre phenomenon, as straightforward as it, or as little thought as we tend to give it.
Well, and as I say this, you also talk about the fact that people who are listening to you talk about itching may notice they're scratching right now. The producers and our engineer in our control room are all saying that they're feeling very itchy, but you write about that too, right? That if you if you listen to people talking about itching, you may notice yourself becoming itchy. And I guess would you say that's a psychosomatic thing?
There certainly is an element of social and psychological a component to scratching ourselves and to perceiving itch. And that leads to it's a pretty big section in the book, but chronic itch is a problem for a lot of people. And it has for a long time been chalked up to psychiatric symptom, or when doctors can't find any organic clear cause of this. So right now you're seeing some medical centers spring up in around the country. There's a center just on curing and treating chronic itch. There's one at Washington University in St. Louis. There's one at Temple in Philadelphia. And so I talked to people at both of these places, and they told me just about the maze of science that's going into trying to understand all the things that can make us itch.
My guest is Jim Hamblin. He's a medical doctor turned journalist. He's a writer. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. One big question that I think, especially this time of year when everyone's really sick, is about our immune system. And I was on the street in Chicago before the holidays, and there was, I will not say the name of a company, they were passing out big boxes of cough drops that were immune. They were like, these are immune boosting cough drops, and it's all echinacea, and it's going to be great. And I took them all throughout the holidays and then told everybody I didn't get sick because I think I had all these little immuno boosts that I was taking. Can you really, I guess, even before I ask, can you boost your immune system? I probably should ask you, what is our immune system?
That is a great question, because for so long we defined systems in the body by structures, by the nervous system being the brain and the spinal cord, and the gastrointestinal system being the stomach and the gut, and musculoskeletal system being so obvious. And then you have the immune system, which is sort of everywhere throughout us, not just our white blood cells, but the skin is the primary barrier in the immune system, which keeps pathogens out. And then we're learning of all these bacteria that form the microbiome, and other microbes that form the microbiome that live inside and on us, that are creating a sense of harmony with these pathogenic disease-causing microbes, and that it is all really this grand balance of most of the systems in our body that are trying to have us not be infected by some invading agent. So then to say that, simply a vitamin C supplement or echinacea is going to protect you from any particular one of these things is a vast oversimplification, and probably not dangerous to take, but it's no good to see people wasting their money on things, or if you have a false sense of security and then you feel like you should go hang out with somebody who's got a cold and you're not going to get sick,
or not get your flu shot because you're like, oh, I drink a lot of vitamin C.
Yes. that's the worst example, because many people die every year of the flu. It's not to be taken lightly, and flu shots are far from perfect, but worth getting.
Jim, are you someone who's super skeptical then about all of these, any kind of marketing that you see for vitamins, or now we've seen all of these immune system, like sort of the whole notion of probiotics, which I think is something that's new and not very well understood, at least not from a lay, certainly not from a lay perspective. And it seems to be sort of a new growing edge of science and health. How do you approach all of these things?
Well, yeah, to go off probiotics, I think that is just something that everyone is going to have a careful eye on in coming years, because it's getting so big so quickly, and we know so little about anything that is actually effective in this realm, or that would be effective for all people, given that we're all very, very different, and the microbes that inhabit us are very, very different from one person to the next. So they're regulated as dietary supplements as opposed to pharmaceuticals. So you can put them on the market without proof that they do anything. And you can make claims that strongly imply that your product does something like boost the immune system without evidence for that. So then it's on the consumer to go back and try to figure out what's what. So I tend to... Be very skeptical of all that stuff, and I know it's tough to point people to any particular resource as to know what works and what doesn't. But hopefully, having some sort of relationship with a doctor or other expert who can try to parse out some of these marketing claims, I think that's really worthwhile.
And what's your best advice for when you're doing your own research, as opposed to, as you said, have a good relationship with a health professional? But when you people who are doing their own research, what's sort of your best advice for people to have good critical thinking and be able to evaluate whether or not something is a good source of information from a health perspective or a medical perspective online?
Well, if you're just reading lay media, I think that's something that's useful for everybody to be good at evaluating what is reasonable journalism and what seems like it's just trying to sell a product. So are you hearing downsides to the product? Are you hearing someone who seems to be approaching this with a strong degree of skepticism? Are you hearing that this has been studied in a lot of people for a long time? It's easy to make news stories out of people who ate a piece of chocolate every day for a week and ended up having higher levels of energy. But we don't, that's really not meaningful in the long term. And so, length of time, number of people. And then does it seem like you're getting a full picture of skepticism in the story?
We're almost out of time, but I had one last question for you, which is unfortunately kind of a big one. Can we even determine what healthy is, do you think?
I think it's important that people have an understanding of what healthy means to them, and that you're not shooting for something that's unattainable given the physical circumstances and social circumstances of your life, and that you're happy, and that people realize that life is, it comes with sickness and disease, and it ends in death for all of us. It's a sad note to end the interview on, but that, the whole last section of the book is about death and dying, and something that we don't like to talk about in this country. But how many people's later years could be so much better
if we did, right?
More meaningful, mm-hmm. If we did.
Yeah. I want to thank Jim Hamblin. He's a doctor. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. We'll